everybody, or good afternoon, everybody, whenever it is that you get your podcast fix. My name is Derek Smith, and this is the Truth or Derek Show, or the Truth or Derek Podcast. You know, the Truth or Derek, whatever it is that you want to call it, as long as you hit that download button, stream, reach out to me any way you want. We got so much good stuff after the last couple of shows. Cheryl and Lisa were incredible. You guys love that. I got so much feedback, even after Josh, Franz, and Danielle and all that. But a lot of the feedback was like, you know, I really got to get into it. So I'm going to get to a few things today because I'm dying. We're talking with Josh Schiffer. I know everyone loves him. I was out with a few people today, and they were like, when is Josh back? When is Josh back? He's back today, and he's back with the great Matthew Mangino. And you guys know, if you ever want to grab them, if you're a podcaster out there and you want to rap with them, well, you can head over to www.podstars.net. They're over there. What is Podstars? It is a talented and passionate community that will give you the opportunity to interview top professionals from a variety of industries where they will share their insights and experiences with your audience. Plus, everybody will have access to the exclusive celebrity catalog featuring some of the best in the business, both new and established. It's also free to join. As a member of Podstars, you can choose from the catalog of celebrities to interview on your podcast, and if interested, for only an additional monthly fee of $8.99 a month, you can upgrade to the community plan, a completely different and exciting catalog full of some of the best experts and professionals in their fields today, as well as access to everybody in the whole Podstars universe. It's a great way to invest in your podcast, as you will save time and money by being able to book guests from one platform with an expansive catalog that is constantly being added to. So why wait? Don't wait. Come on. Join www.podstars.net now and start exploring all they have to offer. You will not want to miss out on this amazing opportunity to elevate your podcasting career and be a part of the exciting community. And excitement it is. Again, I was just saying we got a bunch of new listeners and a bunch of new spots before California really wasn't a thing. We had a bunch of people down download that. I'm guessing we can thank Danielle Vasanova for that. That was a couple episodes ago. She was fantastic. So much positive feedback on that. So much positive feedback from obviously Josh and Franz kind of carried that one. After that, Cheryl and Lisa, incredible. So much feedback. But the thing was, this episode with Matthew Mangino and Schiffer actually ran a little bit long. So I know I say this every week, but I have all your questions. I have all your comments and everything. The longer ones, I decided to knock off some of the quicker ones today, some of the shorter ones, but then again, you never know. Believe me, we had Josh and Matt on. I could have went for 2 or 3 hours. The guys are incredible, just brilliant, brilliant lawyers. So what was the first one that came in? Roger, California, one of our first California downloads. Again, where you're normally in the South, I know. After we talked to Joseph Scott Morgan, Florida blew up. We've always had a bunch of Oklahoma and New Jersey comes in hard. Pennsylvania comes in hard. I know that's Matthew Mangino's backyard. Georgia always, Louisville, and some Kentucky, everything. So you know what? I love it. I love the feedback. I love it all. Again, if you want to reach out to me, just go on Twitter at Derek Vampire Slayer. Shoot me an email, podstars.connect@outlook.com. Or just Google the Truth or Derek Show. I'm all over the place. And again, shoot me any questions, comments, positive, negative, doesn't matter. I got thick skin. I can take it. Although you guys don't send over a lot of hate. I'm sure that's coming one day. I know my wife listens to the show from time to time. And I was talking about some of the movies that I didn't like, and I wasn't thrilled with TikTok and all that sort of thing. And she's like, you're going against the grain a little bit, you know. You're eventually going to get a whole bunch of emails saying you're stupid, you're this, you're that. But it hasn't happened yet. It used to when I used to sing a little bit more. When we first started out, we were talking about Sam Roberts and other bands and stuff. You guys are like, Jesus, you have a terrible voice. But you listen to the whole show, so it couldn't have been that bad. Anyways, so sorry, Roger wrote from California. I'm jealous of your weather, let me tell you that. If you could save one thing in a fire, what would it be? And I know this is a trap because the obvious answer would be my wife and my dog and my two cats. I know if you follow me on Twitter, I'm always posting pictures of the dog, cats, and wife. But I guess you're saying one like, you know, solid item. One people are perishable. One item. What would I save? See, it might sound stupid unless you get it. I would again, I have my phone, all my pictures are on the cloud and all that sort of thing. So it's not like I'm being not sentimental, but I think I would save my mattress. I don't know if anybody out there has had issues with that, but I know when my wife and I first met, we bought one at one of these. It was the weirdest thing. They had this really shady shady factory in Scarborough, which is like a suburb of Toronto, in like an industrial district and all that sort of thing. And it was just one of these old buildings that didn't have any cars parked outside. And it just said like mattresses and office furniture on it. So it wasn't too far from where our first apartment was. So we thought, you know what? Go check it out. Why not? They had a restaurant, a really good Chinese food joint around the corner. So we were there. We said, you know what? Let's go in and check it out. Sure enough, we go in there. And I don't know what kind of scam this guy had going, because like none of the mattresses had labels on them, which apparently is illegal to remove a label from a mattress. And the guy's like, yeah, they're all Sealy's and Serta's. And you can tell some of them were branded and some of them weren't, this, that, and the other thing. But it was like, we had just gotten together and we didn't have a lot of dough. We certainly didn't have like the mattress I have now, I think. Well, we talked about that with Josh and Frauds on an episode a few times ago. It was like $6,000, but I got it on sale for, I don't know, half that, give or take. But, you know, I certainly didn't have $3,000 17 years ago to buy a mattress. So when we went in and we were talking to the guy, again, it wasn't at all what I expected. I really thought you were going to walk into, like, you know, God knows what. And sure enough, they had, like, you know, I would say 150 different mattresses there. We tried one. It was just, it felt good. But, you know, you never know. But, again, I think they were like, you know, it was regular $3,000 or whatever it was. The guy's like, you know, I'll give it to you for like $450 cash. And considering we actually wanted to sleep on a mattress, we said, yeah, you know, that's fine. So yeah, got it back to the apartment, you know, set it up and all that sort of thing, slept on it. Without question, the best sleep I've ever had in my entire life. And then we ended up having that pretty much up until the time we moved out to where we are now. So we had it for 8 or 9 years, just to the point where it was kind of beat to shit. I'm a bigger guy, so obviously. But you know what? The funny thing is, I mean, like we use a mattress protector and stuff, so it was still in really, really good shape. So we moved it to the guest bedroom. And whenever we'd have guests stay over, they'd sleep in it and say, like, that was one of the best sleeps I've ever had in my entire life. So this thing was just like magic. Obviously, when it came time to replace it, we went back there. But like a lot of those business, I think after that, they were selling like, I don't know, like a bunch of weird, like bootleg food stuff that was sort of expired. Like this place had like a skid, no word of a lie, a skid of some brand I've never heard of, like packaged gravy, like those ones you just add a cup of water to and boil it. Like for the whole skid, it was like $25. It was probably like 12 or 13,000 packets of gravy that was expired by like a month. Yeah, so we weren't able to get one from there. So, and my wife never lets me live it down because I went to this stupid place out here. It's called like the mattress barn. Tried out a few there, thought we found one that we liked, bought it, but this wasn't like one of those main ones where you can sleep on it for 30 days and send it back. So, we get it home. We try it out. It's horrible. It was just horrible. I don't remember the brand, but I don't want to shit talk about it. But we tried it with this, we tried it with that, different sheets, different blankets, a duvet, and it was just, it was like sleeping on a fucking pool table. So we bought a mattress topper from Costco, I think it was, which is actually kind of a cool thing. But even that didn't help, and like it almost made it worse. It was just like sleeping on this foam that was on top of this rock. The whole thing was just awful. And kind of now, keep in mind, my house is a good size, but it ain't that big. So now we have the king size mattress that we love in the spare room. Now we have a second mattress floating around, and now we have to go buy a third mattress. So after a lot of hemming and hawing, I eventually twisted my arm, and she got me to buy the expensive one that was on sale. And again, it's fantastic, and I'm really hoping that it lasts forever because I don't know, man. That is, you know. You spend a third of your life in bed. That is an intimate relationship that I'm not ready to give up yet. So if the house is burning down, I am strapping the mattress to my back, looking outside, assuming I have my phone and my pictures, my cats, my dog, and my wife. I like this one here. Sarah, back in New Jersey. I think she sent a whole bunch of questions last week. What is your favorite karaoke song? Well, again, you see, that's the problem is... I put it up on Twitter a little while ago. I was singing Antihero by Taylor Swift. Whether we like to admit it or not, I think I'm a Swiftie. But yeah, I've never actually gotten a chance to sing that at karaoke. We're in the Dominican Republic. I sang Gautier, somebody that I used to know, just because that was the first thing that came to mind. The problem with karaoke is you've usually had a couple of drinks beforehand, so you don't the sound coming out of your mouth doesn't exactly match the sound that's in your head. So, I don't know, when I was younger, I used to sing, like, the Village People and stuff like that. But you know what? It'll be Dynamite video, but I am anti-heroing Taylor Swift the next opportunity I get to do some karaoke. So, I'm sticking with that. I love that song, and I'm going to belt it out to the back row. One more. I thought it was interesting, because if you've listened the last couple of weeks, it seems like some people are throwing in, like, peppering in a serious question here and there, which, again, I always get a kick out of. Believe me, the next show or two, I have all your feedback. I've gotten like 15 or 20 great questions, but they're just ones that I'm going to have to dive into a little bit more. And obviously, I'm trying to keep these episodes as close to an hour as possible. I mean, you guys say you don't mind, and I really appreciate that. But, you know, the main event here is obviously the talent, the Josh and the Matthew, or the Cheryl and the Lisa, or the Danielle and Franz and all that. So, you know, I just try to throw in a little bit of preamble in there to lighten the load before we dive into whatever the heck it is we're diving into. The next one's actually really exciting because we've been in talks with Jennifer Coffendaffer. If you're familiar with her, she's an FBI agent, but so much more than that. Just all over socials. She's all over the news. She's brilliant, brilliant FBI agent. Into everything. One of those people you can ask her about anything. And we're going to dive in. We're going to get the UFO. We're going to get all the dirt. And also, you know, some FBI input on what's going on lately. It's crazy times out there. And look at me rattling on again. So, yeah, the last one, he actually wrote down, and I'll ask Franz the next time he's on. He wasn't on with Josh because we recorded this when Franz was on a religious retreat. They said, you know, a question for you and for Franz, is it okay to lie? For me, my answer is it a hard yes. Is it absolutely okay to lie? And I'll tell you why. If you, to spare somebody else's feelings, like I have some people in my family and stuff like that that are always like, oh, you know, I tell it like it is. I tell it like it is. And for me, that is not a good quality in somebody, because you're ultimately just going to end up hurting somebody else's feelings for no reason. You know, if I eventually, when I eventually sing my Taylor Swift anti-hero, you know, if somebody else has sung that, I would say, you know what, you did a good job. You hit some of the notes and all that sort of thing. If anybody else is like, you know what, I had trouble doing that, if you're just going to make them feel bad. So just, you know, telling little white lies to be supportive, to help somebody else out, no harm in that. You know, spare somebody else's feelings. If you're late because you were doing anything, tell a little fib. There was traffic. I had to stop to do this. My kids were doing whatever. It's, again, telling huge lies like, I didn't kill that guy. That's bad. Don't kill anybody. But, you know, if you're, you know, 10 minutes late because you slept in, and then you tell the person, hey, listen, you know, my cat has diarrhea and I had to wash it. No harm in that. So, I was going to say, long story short, too late. Little lies okay, big lies not okay. No murder, no kitty cat poop. No problem. Yes, again, I got all the other stuff, and I really thank everybody for reaching out. A whole bunch of new download spots. That seems like our little Truth or Derek Nation's getting bigger. Love that. And again, I love you guys for everything you do. Hit the download, stream, feedback, tell your friends, whatever it is. But what it is the great Joshua Schiffer and the fantastic Matthew T. Mangino hopping on right here, right now. Let's go. We got a special episode indeed. Our first guest needs no introduction. He's a pretty darn good defense attorney who was once the former district attorney of Lawrence County. He wrote a fantastic book called The Executioner's Toll. He is a syndicated columnist, an adjunct professor, and a regular on the Law Crime Network, telling it like it is and eating cheesesteaks, the amazing Matthew T. Mangino. Joined by our Hall of Fame Truth or Derek podcast original, he defends Georgia with brilliance and style. He's all over social media, as well as Court TV, ATL News One, CNN, anywhere they need great advice. He loves cats. He loves court documents, especially when they're redacted. He is the great Joshua Schiffer. And how are you doing, fellas?
Jake, it's really a pleasure to be with you two guys. I mean, it's I'm finally in the big time. I'm with you guys.
I'm gonna steal that because I'm still I never get a chance to appear, Matt, and he's awesome. Like, if you look at my feed, he's one of the guys that gets the regular retweet. Like, he is putting out articles. He is sharing the news that I read. Like, that's one reason I just am thrilled to see Matt. That, like, this is really cool for me. And it also happens to be an almost illegally gorgeous day here in the American South. It is 81 degrees and spring has sprung. And if I wasn't sitting here watching the YSL trial, pulling out my hair, the little hair that remains left, I'd be outside enjoying it because this has been one hell of a week. In the universe of law and crime.
No, I wanted to talk. See, we got so much to get to. Like we've kind of got this thing streamlined a little bit now, but and I wanted to talk a little bit about YSL. But there's no way that we can cover that and the Puff Daddy thing, right? So, if we have some time, we'll talk a little bit of YSL. But I'm just on that topic. It seems like a RICO trial. You know, we've talked a lot about that in the last little while. 5 years ago, if it was a thing, it wasn't in the news like it is now. So.
Well, it was only in the news when it was the Rudy Giuliani mafia trial. And people don't remember. RICO's been around for a minute. Rudy, when he was the hero of the prosecution universe, he's the one that brought that statute and used it effectively to basically take down the five families in New York starting the 70s. And that began the evolution that now results in, like you're saying, it seems like every big case is going to be a RICO. In Georgia, we just found out last night there's a new 150 co-defendant case where they busted a 150 people involved in sneaking material, contraband materials into our prison system. So there's guards, there's gangsters, there's family members, there's patsies, there's everything involved. Cat, get your butt out of my face.
Maybe some clients too.
Exactly, but how we had banking too big to fail. What's too big to try? 150 defendant, it's one. How do you find 150 non-conflicted lawyers that practice criminal? And this is outside of Atlanta. This is kind of rural Georgia. You don't have 150 lawyers.
Well, like Matthew just said, hopefully the richest one of those walks into Europe.
It's the only way YSL is going is because Brian Steele is getting thoroughly paid. That trial is 40 witnesses in out of a proposed 400.
Oh man,
Right.
that is lawyers getting rich. Just to go
Yeah.
back a second, I'll ask Matthew this because I know that he's kind of worked both the prosecution and the defense. With the Puff Daddy thing, like we'll say like it's early on because I don't want to talk about some of the rumors and stuff. Well, I'll do some more homework or we'll have somebody on that knows a little bit more about that. But I'm talking about the case in particular. Do you guys think that because I mean he's a little bit more famous than YSL. Is this an opportunity for the like to for them to shake the tree a bit to kind of go back? I mean he's been doing this, they're saying, for 20 to 30 years. But like, is this like to go back and try to group everything in, like between the shooting, the alleged shooting with Jennifer Lopez and all that? So you can grab him, with what is happening now, and can you kind of branch this out and kind of put 30 or 40 people in jail, or is this just a pick two or three of the biggest charges and put him in jail for 50 years?
Well, I mean, I would say that certainly, an investigation can go in a lot of different directions, and you may start at one point and end up someplace completely different ultimately. I mean, you have a basis for moving forward the way that you have, but that can lead in a lot of different areas, and then a lot of people are at risk, and they start talking, and investigations expand. I think one thing might be, well, obviously homicide doesn't have a statute of limitations, but some cases do, and that's going to have some impact if you're talking about going back 20 or 30 years. But investigations always lead to surprises, and this may be one of those types of cases.
Yeah, like the investigation's going to lead him ideally to information. And that's really what a good investigation is. It doesn't already know what it's looking for 100%. They've got ideas. Oh, we've heard allegations of this, that, and the other. But a good investigation will approach with open eyes, willing to take everything independently. And whatever they can develop, that's the job of a good detective. That's the job of a good a prosecutor, is to put this stuff together. And when it gets back into really reaching back into time, individual predicate incidents may not be within a prosecutable statute of limitations, but they can still be over acts that go into the creation of whatever the RICO charge is, just as evidence of the relationship well predating the racketeering that's going on currently or recently. We also have to not get lost in the P. Diddy, the world of cases. So everybody's talking about the case, the case, the case. There's a lot more than just one case. There's a federal investigation, but no one knows what the charges are going to be yet because they haven't revealed them. They're doing the investigation, and we know that it involves allegations that have been contained in some civil suits, but we also don't know what other allegations they're working off of. And so it's hard to speculate. Other than that, they marshal together an enormous amount of human power to simultaneously raid multiple places. And you're talking hundreds of agents and officers involved in what I imagine they had some good justification for that. You're not getting warrants for all that stuff unless you know what you're going after.
So, Matthew said about the statute of limitations. Obviously, murder, there isn't any. Assuming, I mean, I don't want to get in the rumors, but I have heard about some of the brutal stuff that's gone on. But particularly when it comes to money, I mean, I can't imagine, we'll say the tax man, for example, the government, if they do find significant amounts of fraud or payouts or whatever it is, that just doesn't get swept under the rug. I would imagine that there's some sort of, again, when you said people are going to start to turn on them. And you see that, if there's 10 or $15 million, because I wanted to talk about the Shohei Ohtani situation a little bit too, because that's sort of in with the money. Is there a follow the money here, or is that after 5 years, you're scot-free?
Well, I mean, I think there's always going to be follow the money, and there's always going to be some pressure. I mean, we know that some of the most famous gangsters of all time ultimately went down on tax evasion and things like that. I would say that money, depending on the context, is sometimes more easy to look into, to follow, than maybe some other issues, especially with regard to large sums of money. I don't think he's going down to the local bank and depositing $1 million in cash, but there are sophisticated forensic accountants and others who can really piece together a money trail, which ultimately can lead to other criminal charges as well.
And what we see is the money part being the side leverage when they're doing the investigation, because whenever money's exchanging, there are obligations on the person sending the money as well as receiving, and those obligations kind of stand independent of the criminal investigation. So you can get charged with drug dealing and da 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 da, and then after disposal, theoretically, there are tax implications. And in fact, you can buy tax stamps for marijuana, even though marijuana was illegal forever and ever. There were still valid tax stamps. And even with firearms cases, there are licenses that you ostensibly have to buy. So there can be independent tax enforcement issues. But if you're getting investigated and the Fed knocks on your door, you've got that immediate criminal. Oh my God, they're going to ask me about what Matt and I have been talking about that's super illegal. But if Matt's given me money or I've given him and it's not recorded, there's that side end of, hey, Mr. Schiffer, if you don't want to cooperate and tell us what you've done with Mr. Mangino, we're going to have to look into some of the taxes. So it becomes this collateral attack squeeze where even though you're fine talking to us about this, you know, we're poking around and not, we all know you aren't reporting this money. So it adds to that recipe of how you build a case. And that is using the financial records, which are very often just document-based, easy to say, man, this is when the money got deposited. This is where the money went. And there are records of that. And if money's moving in a way that is unaccounted for or wrongfully accounted for, that's evidence of some malfeasance. And with the Fed, man, you give them a crack to get into the room, they're getting all the way into the room and they're explore every corner. That's exactly what they're going to do. One by one, all these people in P. Diddy's life are going to get a thorough examination and poking into. And what comes out of that, P. Diddy should be kind of concerned.
Right. And the thing is, whenever you're dealing, you know, with the federal government, I mean, they have the ability to cherry pick. So, you know, it's not like the local prosecutor's office where you got to prosecute every single case that comes across your desk because some police officer filed it or one of your assistants approved it. The federal government sits back and they can cherry pick. They take the best cases. That's why 98% of cases end up in pleas in federal court. You know, so you know, when the feds are snooping around with the resources that they have at their disposal, with, as we've already said, everything from the Internal Revenue Service to ATF to the FBI, you have problems. You have big problems.
So
It's the
my
big difference when you actually are dealing with retail clients and they come to you. And it's an absolutely different approach with the state versus Fed. In state crime, a crime happened and a bunch of law enforcement was dispatched to investigate and then probably make up an indictment and arrest some people. Federal, just like Matt said, they're sitting back. They're watching this stuff from the comfort of their offices. They gather all the facts. And then when you find out they're after you, half the time it's them just sending you a letter. Hey, sir, we know what's up. Why don't
bad
you?
news.
And
Yeah.
when I'm the lawyer, I'm like, all right, so client, this is what's going to happen. We're not going to run. We're not going to hide. We're going to meet with them. And here's what that meeting looks like. Hey, Mr. Schiffer, I'm AUSA Steve. Here's a disc with all the discovery. Here's everything we know about your guy that we're going to share with you. That completely convicts him from day one. We're going to give you an opportunity to plead guilty on an information, not an indictment. And that's going to give the judge and us a lot more flexibility to not bend your guy over. Don't make us do that extra work because if we do, there's a cost. And
Now,
you take the materials, you go look at it. It's the wiretaps, it's the pictures, it's everything. And your client's like, can I do anything? And that's the point. The Fed wants to bury you so hard you don't even want to fight.
I have a two-part question to follow up on that. One of them was one that Matthew and I were talking about yesterday, was like a penalty, like money, obviously, for, you know, appealing something like this. But who pays for the prosecution side on the initial charge? Like, I would imagine this is going to cost the state tens of millions of dollars just to get this in front of a judge.
Regular state budget, that's prosecutor budget stuff.
But if you had, you know, a dozen of these cases come up in, you know,
It would give you a
Oklahoma.
lot of reasons to go to your state legislature and ask for a lot more money.
Right. So assuming he lose he loses this, and you know, the state's out, we'll say $10 or $15 million. You said, okay, the state pays for that. He's going to appeal, and you get a second swing at that. Like, at some point, is there going to be a system where say you could take another swing at this, but you have to pay for it?
Well, or what case are you talking about? A specific case right now where the state, when you're saying
No,
millions of dollars, okay.
we were just asking about like a penalty for
It's just
appealing
generally,
the
yeah.
trial. Yeah.
Well, so one of the things that you know, When I said the trial penalty and the appeal penalty, what I mean by that, and I'm and Josh is very familiar with this as well, and I think it's a problem in the criminal justice system, and that is, so you've been arrested, and your case is being prepared for trial, and the prosecutor offers you a plea bargain. Here's our plea agreement. This is what we'll let you plead guilty to. And you say no. Okay. And let's say that that plea agreement was 2 to 4 years in a state correctional facility. Instead, you go to trial. And then you go to trial, you get convicted, and that 2 to 4 offer on a plea is way, way back in history. So now you're going to get 5 to 10. I mean, the prosecution's going to argue, well, he's been convicted on three things. Our plea offer was to run those currently, to run them all at the same time. But now we want them to run consecutively. So instead of 2 to 4, you're going to get 6 to 12. So that's the trial penalty. That being
Right.
penalized for exercising your constitutional right to go to trial.
That's the headline. Penalized for exercising your right to go to trial. And the two places I see it, just like Matthew said, the big cases are, hey, Josh, if your client wants to plead guilty to this, we'll give him straight probation. Now, if you go to trial, man, all offers are off the table, and this judge, and judge isn't part of the plea negotiations. Judge may not even inquire as to what offers were made. And the judge, I have one judge that colloquially known as Maximum Mary, where her threat to the entire criminal bar, if you get convicted, you're getting every last minute. And what does that do to the system? It tells every plea. Doesn't matter if it's a crappy plea, take a plea. Because if you lose a trial, you're getting every last day. The other one of those is for like something small like a DUI. In Georgia, the gimme DUI first lifetime is, the rest of 24 hours in jail that's always waived and some probation and stuff. Totally livable. Now, if you want to go to trial, 90% of judges aren't going to give you that offer if you're convicted. They're going to give you a couple days in jail or a week in jail, 10 days. And that is basically a judicial coercive threat to not exercise your right. And that's the problem. You shouldn't be penalized for standing up for yourself.
You know what?
And
That's
here's the other thing, just real quick,
yeah.
Derek, that leads to as well. Okay. And so, sometimes you see where a person has been exonerated when they actually, confessed or where they actually pled guilty to an offense. And so you wonder yourself, how does that happen? I mean, how could a guy plead guilty to something he didn't do? And you if you look at these very things that we're talking about, let's say, for instance, you have a criminal history. So in Pennsylvania, we use sentence guidelines, and many states do. In Georgia, I'm not sure, but I'm sure
Oh,
they
we
have
go into
some.
the history. Yeah,
Yeah.
absolutely.
So you have this scheme. So in Pennsylvania, for instance, if you have prior felonies, you're going to have a prior record score that's high. Then when you look at the guidelines, that's going to impact, the length of your sentence. So let's say, for instance, a guy has a couple of felonies and he gets accused of a crime that he actually didn't commit. So this one he didn't commit, and he's accused of. He, because of that trial penalty, he's afraid to go to trial, even though he's innocent, because he knows if he gets convicted with that prior record, he's going to get hammered. So what the district attorney does is come to him and say, hey, we'll give you, 18 to 36 months, plead guilty to this and be on your way. Whereas if he went to trial and got convicted with consecutive sentences, he might get 18 years.
Jesus.
So he pleads guilty to something that he didn't do because he realizes the consequences of getting convicted. And that's a shame.
And it's risk management from the practitioner's perspective. I owe you a duty to give you my honest professional opinion. Here's, man, you got three priors. So yeah, I know we're really innocent on this, but the state's going to offer you straight probation, and that's basically a given. Judge will approve that. But because of your priors, and I know you're innocent, they're going to bring those priors up and use the same tiger doesn't change its stripes argument they always do. And there's some jurors that are going to hear about a prior record and try to convict. Man, trial is a speculative sport. And if you get convicted, you go to prison. So you turn around and reverse roles with the client. Hey, this guy that I paid a bunch because he's smart and does this all the time said, stay out of jail, but be on probation or risk going to prison. It's not a hard twist unless you've got someone who's really stuck on principle, which you love. But then, of course, you get to the fact that people really stuck on principle probably don't make good decisions in the rest of their life. Because if you're going to go to prison on principle, that's awesome. I've been to prison. Terrible.
It you know, principle, you know, that's one of the things. Usually I walk away from a case when the client says it's about principle, okay? Because as the cost goes up, principle goes down. And so you know, getting through this, when they told you, listen, I don't care, I just want to teach this guy a lesson, and then you start sending them the bill, and all of a sudden that lesson wasn't quite as important as
Not
they
so
thought it was when they
important.
first started.
Well, and it's why when we're dealing with cases, especially on bigger, complex cases, the value of cutting and running are huge. Look at the co-defendants in Georgia versus Trump. Four or five of them are already pled first offender, misdemeanor. Man, done. They ain't showing up for anything. And it's gone. And that's it. There's a huge value in that surety because the process of going and standing up for yourself, the process of defending against a charge, that process has become the punishment. In Georgia now, like the YSL case, those gentlemen are incarcerated during a trial that has no appreciable end, that the judge can't tell. Those guys are basically indefinitely incarcerated. In multiple facilities because they can't be housed together. It's a giant expense for the state for the next year, more than a year.
Yeah, if
And
you're on.
that gets to Eighth Amendment. And what are we doing, people? This is just an amazing waste of resources.
And like you said, you're only 40, you're 40 people through 400 on that case. So you said a year. That's like, that's erring on the
Well,
side of caution.
it indefensible.
Well, you know, the other thing that we were talking about a little bit yesterday, and it ties into what we were talking about last week with how crazy the bail system is, because we had a lot of people were sending messages and tweeting and stuff about it, but that they had no idea that the bail system was like then. And especially the case you told us, Josh, where when you were a clerk, you had to, the people were
Oh,
horrified.
take away someone's house. Yeah,
You had to take
it
away
was.
the elderly people's house, even though the judge told them, do not sign this bail. So, like we've talked about in the past, do you guys see a better bail system, or is it just, it's broken the way it is because it's broken the way it is?
Well, you know, I would say that, cash bond, monetary bond is unfair. Okay. Now, I think that there are legitimate reasons for some people to have a high bond or not have any bond at all. Okay. If they're a real risk to flee and they have the means to flee, or they're a danger, and that becomes a little bit, gray. How do you determine that? Whether you use risk assessments or you look at their history, things like that. But it's fundamentally unfair if you have two people who are charged, let's say, with theft, okay? And let's say it's a large amount of money, a theft. All right. One person set a bond at $25,000. Person can post the bond because they have the financial wherewithal to do it, and the other one can't, so they stay in jail. The only difference between those people is their economic status. There's no other difference. One guy has money, The other guy doesn't. The guy without the money stays in jail. All the bail is for is to ensure that someone appears in the future, all as well as, you know, some safety concerns. But bail is about showing up. It's not supposed to be penal. And
specifically,
you know,
it, the courts have ruled on that.
Yeah.
Right. Right. And so when you have a scheme, so to speak, where having money can access freedom and not having money means you stay locked up, there's something wrong with that system.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't make sense.
And it really gets worse when you get overloaded systems, because the disparity increases. If you're trapped in jail and my client's out, and you're in an overcrowded, slow system, you're going to do anything to get out of jail, including take the gimme plea that the state's always willing to offer you. So you're in a different literal legal position than the person who's been released. And Matthew really hits on the key point. The point of bond and bail is to ensure your participation in the system. And I believe that we should streamline the process dramatically, where either you don't get bond or bail assigned because you are a threat to the system, you're a threat to themselves, you're a threat to witnesses, you are not going to show up. There needs to be a big class of people who just don't have bond, and they should be on an accelerated judicial process. They should be attended to before all the people that have bonded out. But the real problem is with the lower level bonds and the slow pace of court and how that disproportionately affects people, because now we have people that are out on bond for years. And what happens when you're out on bond for years is there's a chilling effect on your behavior. The state loves it when you're out on bond, because if you step out a lot, boom, they revoke your bond. Now you're locked up on something that otherwise you shouldn't have been locked up on because of something kind of arbitrary, capricious, and small. Now you're going to take a plea because it's the only way for you to get out of jail. Because if you want to sit and actually have a trial 6 months away, we can put you on a plea calendar next week. And that becomes the math for some people. And yes, there's an enormous amount of bond and release abuse by the general public. We send out failure to appears by the billions, it feels like, in Georgia, but that's because people just don't go to court. And that creates just a broken system. And I don't know what the fix is, other than getting rid of cash bond has been a disaster for those communities and those processes. But don't look at us for doing it well, because our existing cash bond system is a human rights abuse, and it's a license to print money for a very set number of bonds people in the state of Georgia that have the right license that literally allows you to print an income. In Georgia, we have something called the dormant case rule, where after you've been bonded out, you paid your 14% fee to a bonding company, they signed the surety paperwork. If the state hasn't actually brought you to trial, the bondsman is released of their obligation. So in some jurisdictions that are a year or two behind on bringing cases to court, it's just a giveaway to the bond company.
You know, I've never actually heard Matt really said that well, because we've talked about a gay and bail in the past. It's like you take two, we'll just say, violent offenders that didn't commit homicide and both in for the same crime. One gets out because they have money and one doesn't. Like that's, I've never actually heard it put like that. It's brilliant.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, you know, Josh, you know, mentioned, you know, mathematics, you know, if taxpayers would stop and think about the cash bail system. Okay. So again, let's use our two guys commit the same crime. You know, one guy can pay for bond, one can't. So they sit there. Okay. So let's think about even people who are so impoverished that they can't afford a $2,500 bail, which in Pennsylvania might be $175. Okay. So they set the bail. The guy goes in jail, forgets about him. 5 months later, his case comes up for trial. Oh, well, yeah. Geez. Well, you know what? Plead guilty to time served, and you'll be out of jail. The thing is, taxpayers are paying for these people who can't afford these nominal bonds at times. So, you know, when you look at the statistics, you know, in you know, county jails, you know, 65, 70% of the people there haven't been convicted of anything yet. They're sitting there waiting for trial.
Yeah.
And the taxpayers are paying guards for all the costs associated with the jail, with the transportation back and forth for sheriffs, with medical care, with everything that goes along with it. I mean, if you would look at these cases a second time and say, well, hey, this guy's going to show up, you know, he can sign a non-monetary bond. If he doesn't, we'll go pick him up on a warrant.
Yeah.
But why are we going to make him sit here because he can't pay $175 or $250 or $500 when it costs
$175 might as
$100?
well be a million.
But and
Right.
that's what you
If you
also
don't
have to
got
think
it.
about. The criminal justice system is one of the only exchanges in the universe that accepts all clients. It does not matter how rich, poor, smart, dumb, everybody gets turned to criminal justice system. What do you do with the people that, in all of their world, can't scrape together 50 bucks to get out of jail? Or now, really, how low do you got to be before you don't have anybody that will spot you 100 bucks to get out of jail? Like, that's low. But
Those are the
that's the
people that
kind
chip
of
you.
people
If
that you know, when I was a public defender, every morning we would go and misdemeanor first appearance in Fulton County is the 50, 20 to 50 people they rousted that night before. Drunk in public, doing drugs in public, disorderly conducts, hanging around in buildings. These people have nothing. And if you lock them up and give them a bond that costs $10, they're not going anywhere. So what are you really
No.
doing? You're warehousing them. You're disrupting whatever stability they might have had on the outside. They're certainly not going to get their medical care. We do horrible things with medical care incarceration, which upsets any treatment they were actually receiving. So you've got those issues. And then they sit there a week, a month, 6 months, doesn't matter. They're going to sit there until they get put on a calendar and offered time served and the probation they're going to violate. And that's how you get when people, how do you have 71 arrests? Well, every one of them's for being a mentally ill vagrant and hanging around outside. And after sucking up some resources, we kicked them out of the jail.
Well, I just thought of your new bail system is you get them in there. See, call 10 people. Just get one of them to agree to lend you $100 and let you out. If you can't do that in 10 phone calls, you're out of luck.
When you're a baby lawyer in Fulton County, you realize you do not want to get your clients a $500 bond. The minimum bond you want is $1,000 because bonding companies will not write a $500 bond. They will only write a $1,000 bond. So you have the weird, hey, judge, I actually need you to increase that bond to $1,000. And so I would think that if the public understood what was at stake here, and you know that a guy who can't afford $175 to post a $1,500 bond is going to stay in jail at $130 a day A
to the
day.
taxpayers, you know, I think if you just generally send a message out to the community and say, hey, we'd like to save a lot of money here, why don't we all pitch in and bail these guys out? Long run, we're all going to save money. You know, but you know, that's being facetious. But really, you know, people say, oh, lock them up, lock them up, lock them up. They don't realize how much of their tax dollars are going toward locking these guys up.
You can
How
quote the
expensive it is.
Shawshank Redemption. When it comes to prison, they spend the money three ways: more walls, more bars, more guards.
Except now we can't hire guards. There's was a stabbing of a warden, not a PIA, a warden in Middle Georgia, where they have over 50% of the employee positions are unfilled. So imagine that. It's something like
Wow.
39 licensed prison guards for 1,000 people. It is such a
Yeah.
wacky imbalance. We can't pay people to be our prison guards anymore because we have that many people
Yeah.
in prison. And
It,
one of the
and
problems
and
is that in Georgia, we will convict you of anything all the time and put everybody on probation. That's a big problem. I believe we need a more speedy, available justice system where if you're willing to just take 24 hours of straight time, 48 hours of straight time, that's how you clear up some of the jails because so many of the quality of life arrests in urban settings are just moving a guy out of where he's at right then. And it's de-escalating a confrontation, generally with someone who's unhoused, often with someone with mental health. Nobody wants that person to sit and rot in prison. We just don't want them to be harassing that business owner or, yelling at people on the street or need some medical care. I wish we had a better short-term de-escalation process that solved it, because that's many of our chronic people.
Yeah, and I think Josh, you hit the nail on the head, because what we got to do, as a society is spend more money on the people that we're afraid of than
Yep.
on the people we're sort of pissed off at. So we're mad because this guy, urinates in the alley every night, and stands in front of the businesses during the day, so we throw him in jail. Just mad at the guy. We're not afraid of him. The people that we're afraid of is, the people who are out, gang banging and shooting and robbing, and that's where our resources go. But the more we shift the resources toward the people we're mad at, we take them away from the people that we are afraid of and should be spending those resources on.
And if the people that you're afraid of have money, it doesn't matter anyways, because they'll be out in
Right.
24 to 48
Well, yeah,
hours.
no, they get good luck. But really, what Matthew's talking about is the fact that we've got this few percent of our population that tends to be high intensity use with law enforcement resources. And whether it's the way God made them, whether it's their involvement, I don't know. But you see the frequent flyers, and it would be, when you work down there as a public man, you'd see the same people. If your last name is Favors in the city of Atlanta, man, I've represented all your cousins. I know everybody in the damn family.
You guys got
And
money? Yeah.
that's society's commentary. I can't fix this. But I know that we disproportionately spend a lot of resources on a really discrete small group of chronic and routine offenders that deserve their rights, but they deserve a hell of a lot better than just getting continuously locked up, released, locked up, released, locked up, released.
You guys a few minutes ago mentioned dumb criminals. We somebody wrote in a question. Laura from Jacksonville. Have you noticed an increase of dumb criminals as a result of social media challenges? And she quoted one, and she quoted on it. She sent a clip to a case of one of the January 6 people, who actually got charged because after he went out of the building, he asked a cop to go back into the building to get his phone because he plugged it in to charge.
Oh yeah, listen, social media, posting things, on different platforms has solved more crimes in the last, I would
Amen.
say 10 years, than anything else I can think of. I mean, it's just incredible to see, the one guy, that was a classic. The police had noticed that someone was siphoning gasoline out of their police cars when they were parked, at the police station. Okay, so they're thinking about, well, let's we need to get some cameras in a certain area where these. Lo and behold, the guy is videotaping himself siphoning the gas out of the police cars,
License plate and all.
and put yeah, and puts it on whether it was Facebook or whatever. But
TikTok,
they're,
yeah.
they're the police. Yeah, they're trying to figure out, hey, four cameras, this guy's posting himself siphoning the gas out of. So, the things people say and write and post are just unbelievable, and ultimately leads to more and more arrests. I mean, every police department that has any sort of resources, has an intelligence officer that's, frequently checking, social media posts and things like that, because it's like a wonderland for law enforcement.
And to quote my evidence professor, those are admissions. They're super admissible. You don't have to contextualize them at all. Did your client say, yeah, okay, then it's really coming in. And now, like, look at these RICO cases. A bunch of the evidence are voluntary posted TikTok videos and pictures of you holding a bunch of dope and guns, doing stuff that I don't care if it's artistic or not. Jurors are going to look at it and be like, well, now I see exactly what you're doing there. And now that we have these pocket Fourth Amendment violations, well, you've given somebody else the ability to track where you are 24 hours a day. You've given some of the apps the ability to turn on your microphone, take pictures. Like the idea, when I was a kid, all the movies were stay off the MF phone. Like there's the casino bit where it's Robert banging the phone, stay off the phone.
Stay off the
Now
fucking phone.
these people are like, hold on, let me just admit this in a, and it's like you people are just handing them the case. If you do it digitally, I've got a guy I can pay that can get it for me. I don't care about your signal. We've got a big case here with 60 co-defendants and everything. Oh no, communications, they're all encrypted and well, except when they flip one guy and then he opens up the signal and then hold on, all of the messages were shared with everybody. So F your secret no, man. Y'all don't know how to do this. You're terrible criminals. The only safest thing in the world, pen, piece of paper. If I've got something that's really secret, it's never getting near a computer. It's going to go on a piece of paper. And if I really want, I can stick that in a safe. Because if you email it, man, you may as well be reading it to your grandmother.
My favorite one, it was also a Facebook one. The guy had done an armed robbery in the morning. And then he posted a video on Facebook later on with the gun, and he was wearing the same clothes. And he was talking about the robbery.
And you've got the facial recognition issues now where really high. So retail theft is obviously a multi-billion dollar issue. You don't think the CVSs and the Walmarts and all those of the world aren't investing tremendous amounts of money on identification software that they're not even going to share with the government until they've got it all perfect. They can track you. Stop thinking that you're doing all this stuff hidden. You are not a ninja. If you're doing stuff and it involves being out in surveillance, odds are you're getting watched.
A lot of people were fascinated. I know a few people wanted to ask Matt because he's played the prosecution game of it. It was Teresa in New Jersey was talking about, let's use the Puff Daddy case for example, if it eventually gets to court, about how you guys work the different techniques of jury selection. So she asked, who would you want on your jury and who would you not want on your jury?
Well, that's one of the benefits of being a prosecutor because you have resources at your disposal. Unless you're really a defendant that has a lot of resources, and usually when we see defendants like that, they're successful. They can go out and get jury consultants and things like that. But you're not going to do that in every case, but in high profile cases, you might. And so you really want to have a profile of a juror that would work in a given case. I mean, it's going to be fact specific. It's going to deal with issues of who the potential witnesses are and how someone would interact, or whether they be put off with a certain manner in which people testify. So you know it's really, and again, if you're in a high profile case and you have the resources, you're going to want to do that. But typically, we as lawyers don't have that in every case, and there's always certain things that you look for on a given case. I mean, there's a lot of prosecutors who will tell you that they don't like to have teachers on a jury. And there are specific reasons. The teachers are inquisitive by nature, like your
Smart.
students are. Yeah, they're smart. Sometimes you don't want necessarily
Smart people.
highly intelligent people, engineers, people who want answers. Okay, they in their world, there's answers. You know, when engineers working, he's going to come up with whatever formula, whatever he uses, and he's going to have specific answers. He's not going to build the bridge based on reasonable doubt. Okay.
Right.
So, you know, those are the kind of people that you closely scrutinize when you're picking a jury.
Yeah, the nice thing about, and my partner Doug's a former prosecutor, and I've worked with lots of prosecutors with our victims practice. When you're picking a jury as a prosecutor, you've got that benefit of built-in righteous indignation because the rules of society have been broken, and you get to lean into and be that positive person who is, you know, I work for you and I'm here to make sure that everything that we share is good. So there's a lot, because you're trying to build 6 or 12 people into a unified force. It's that tribal dynamic. And we get back to the fact that jury selection really is an exclusionary process based on your biases and prejudices, which is that teacher rule. Because I've heard that since I was a baby lawyer. Teachers are one of the ones we love to talk about. Oh, teachers are like that. Oh, no, teachers are like that. Oh, no, teachers. And it's civil and criminal. I think as we get more sophisticated in jury selection, we as practitioners have become more knowledgeable that the individual's responses and our connection with them is a little bit more important than some of the broad brush old tricks. Like, old white guys are all conservative. Well, yeah, no. I got some pretty liberal white dudes that, well, very progressive. We've seen that with the old adages about African-American jurors. And it really racist, really awful stuff. There have been some reversals in courts of appeals from notes held by prosecuting agencies using inappropriate justifications to choose or deny jurors. I think that jury selection gets more important, and everybody's realizing that. And it's about the connection and what you're doing with a juror, where you're going to bring them to go with successful trial lawyers. But of course, many trial lawyers never are successful. They don't enjoy it. They don't get lots of experience. And they just kind of pick jurors using the old handbook. And that doesn't make for a very good trial. Advanced trial techniques and practicing that stuff, that's what's going to make you a better prosecutor. And hopefully good prosecutors are getting that training.
I got a question here from Jason in Tampa. Said, if you could be an attorney in any case in history where you think you could have made a difference, which one?
Well, I'm going to let Josh answer that first.
Yeah, that's a tough. So it's hard to think about famous cases where the side I like lost, because we don't get to hear about those over history. I'd love to say that I would have done better with some of our civil rights cases that never made it anywhere. Because remember, some of the best cases got squashed by insurmountable powers at a very early stage. And it's not fair. And the justice system isn't fair. And very valid grievances never see the light of day. So I'd probably say something like that. The really specific cases, I'd love to be involved in some of the big, you know, policy case. Like, you can hate Ralph Nader all you want. The guy forced the American auto manufacturers to do some crazy stuff when they didn't want to. Some of the environmental groups that have had these massive cases that have benefited the whole world that only would have happened because good people working with non-governmental organizations got together and were dedicated to something they believe in. But, you know, a giant criminal trial one way or another, I don't think I have anything like that real specific.
I know. I think like 5 to 6 months ago, I asked Kirk Nermy that. He was like, mine. I wouldn't have done mine.
It was impactful on his life.
Yeah, I mean, that's a tough, you know, question. You know, you think of the famous cases like, you know, Leopold and Loeb and cases like that, you know, have kind of been historical markers in terms of the criminal justice system. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, as Josh said, you know, some of the civil rights cases, you know, some of the famous cases, you know, like, you know, I had just written an article, a column about the anniversary. Well, it's now Public Defender's Day, but the anniversary of Gideon versus Wainwright. And, you know, it's just fascinating to listen to the tapes, because you can actually listen to the tapes of the argument of Abe Fortas. Because, you know, the ironic thing about Gideon versus Wainwright is that, you know, he wasn't given an attorney when he requested one after being charged with a crime in Florida. But, you know, ultimately his case made it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court appointed Abe Fortas to be his attorney, who later became a justice on the Supreme Court himself. You know, but his argument was so eloquent and so sort of compact and concise. You know, it was a really, I'm not talking about taking Abe Fortas's place in that argument. I was just fascinated by the way he presented it, and what the Supreme Court ultimately did with his argument.
And that's a case that if you'd mentioned it 10 or 20 years ago, so I graduated law school in 2002, a few people would go, oh, I think that, yeah. Now, many lawyers, and they have really done a good job educating non-lawyers about the importance of that decision, and that's come from non-governmental groups like John Rapping runs a group called Gideon's Promise. Right. That becomes something within the criminal defense community that we used to not have. And now we're building institutions through actual agencies, such as state public defender agencies, working in conjunction with those to train defense attorneys the same way that a lot of these pro-state groups have been doing forever. And Trial Lawyers College, Jerry Spence Method, the National NCDC, there are all these groups, and educating the universe about how important cases like Gideon are is part of that. And they've done a great job.
Well, as usual, we never get to most of our stuff, but we do have a few minutes left. So I got a quick trivia, and we're going to rock off a quick draft. We can do the draft first. I'll let Matthew go first. Four rounds. You both get one pick per round. We're doing famous TV shows or TV lawyers or movie lawyers, anything show business lawyers.
Okay. So I get to pick one, or do I get my top four?
You get to go, you get to go four, but you just get to pick one at a time, so you can't steal each other's answers.
Oh, okay.
We'll go back and forth.
Okay,
what's your top entertainment lawyer or lawyer from entertainment?
Matt Law.
You said movies too, so I was going to start off with Atticus Finch.
Atticus Finch.
Arguably the single greatest fictional lawyer ever.
Off the table now, Josh.
Yeah. I'm going to go in the complete opposite direction, and I'm going to go with Lionel Hutz.
He was good until he passed away.
Well, no, Lionel Hutz is a fine lawyer. He's taught many people about punctuation. He inspired many modern practitioners.
All right, Matt, your second pick.
Let's see. Well, I would. Let me see. I would go with Paul Bigler.
Refresh my memory.
Jimmy Stewart in Anatomy of a Murder.
Oh, that was Nermie's favorite too.
Yeah, he was a country lawyer. But it's if you haven't seen it, it's a movie to see, because it really presents some moral dilemmas that an attorney can face.
I think I saw that in school a while ago. Yeah.
Yeah.
Josh, too.
All right. Not necessarily the best example of a lawyer, but one of my favorite lawyers is a character, Dan Fielding, played by John Larroquette on Night Court, sleazy, hyper-masculine male prosecutor who would have slept with the hooker after prosecuting. Like, Dan Fielding was so many good and just a great character.
I'm surprised Matlock and Jake and the Fat Man are still on the table, but Matt, your third pick.
Well, I would have to go with Raymond Burr's Perry Mason.
Oh,
I mean,
that's good.
the guy was undefeated, or maybe he lost one case. You know, and he did it just him and Paul Drake. I mean, he didn't have anything else. He
Yeah,
can't overlook Perry Mason.
somebody told a great joke. It was him or it was one of those television detectives. They said something. It was like, well, what the fuck do you know? You solve 100% of your cases. Josh, number three.
One of the best movies of all time, one of the best lawyer roles of all time. Tom Hagen in The Godfather. The levels that you can interpret the relationship of him as a lawyer, as a mobster, as a man, one of the greatest characters of all time.
All right, Mr. Mangino, your last pick.
Well, yeah, so he took the consigliere away for Don Corleone. But there's a lawyer in a movie that I really like. I don't remember the lawyer's name, okay? But you may you know you or your viewers or listeners may remember Breaker Morant, okay? And Breaker Morant was an Australian movie in which they won the Academy Award for the best foreign film that year. But Edward Woodward, actor, remember from The Equalizer? He was tried for killing Boer prisoners during the Boer War.
Yep,
And
yep, yep.
they had a court martial, because they were kind of like scapegoats. There were three guys on trial. And they had a court martial. Lawyer, basically like a real estate lawyer that they sent to defend Breaker Morant, but the actor in the movie is great, and you know, he of course he fights and fights and subpoenas Lord Kitchener, who was the general of the army. It's a great movie, and he did a great job as a novice trial lawyer in that court martial.
All right, Josh, your last pick.
I keep going through. There's so many good ones. So I'm gonna
Juliana
shoot.
Margulies from The Good Wife. Come on,
I,
your last
so
pick.
Julianne Moore, who is also just a super crush since her time many, many years ago on ER and before.
Right.
She's amazing. My cousin Vinny, come on, you can't talk law in movies.
Pesci.
Possibly the
Yep.
finest legal movie ever made. They literally teach ethics using that movie because there's
Right.
so good examples. Absolutely fantastic. The Al Pacino in what's the one, The Firm? What's the one where he's the truly evil chief lawyer? Isn't Keanu Reeves in that?
Constantine? No,
No, it's not it looks like Constantine,
yeah,
but
I know the one you're talking about.
it's one of the, not Crichton, but one of the author, but it's the truly evil big law evil devil, because that is what a lot of, you know, younger hypermasculine, I'm going to take over the world, be the coolest guy in the universe. What do you want more than a penthouse office with, you know, dozens of junior associates and a black car no matter where you go, and everybody bows and scrapes and treats you? That's the fantasy. And I've met that guy. There's a couple of them out there. They're just very rare, and I think they're secretly very unhappy.
All right, one last quick thing. There's five items,
Okay.
right? All of them sold at auction. I'm going to give you the item, and you got to give me both of you just spit out a money number. It doesn't matter about you over. Who's ever closest wins best out of five.
Okay.
So at an auction, the first iPhone, it was a 4G in its original wrapper, just sold a couple days ago.
$6,000.
Matt?
50,000 dollars.
Matt wins that one. It was sold for 190,000. It was $499 when he bought it. Had he have bought st one stock, it would have paid off 32,000. He bought an iPhone and it just sold for 190,000.
Wow, what a good decision, huh?
Yeah, no kidding.
Right, one of John Lennon's teeth.
Oh, that's a
A tooth.
six figure. Yeah, that's six figures. That's 150
Okay.
grand.
I'm saying 1.1 million.
You know what? You guys would have overpaid. It was one of his molars. It just sold for $31,000. So Josh gets that.
Now you can clone him off of that. That's got DNA in it. That's very low.
They're cloning sheep. Lennon's yeah. be next.
Sheep to John Lennon is a very short jump.
They're right next to each other.
Yeah.
All right. The original glove Freddy Krueger wore in the first Nightmare on Elm Street.
That's almost $100,000. I'm going to go $90,000.
I'm going to say $101,000.
And Matthew could get that one because it sold for $150,000 3 months ago.
Yeah, it almost makes sense.
Alrighty.
More than John Lennon's tooth.
I'm still thinking that we can clone him from that.
They could have bought it. They could have bought
cloning John Lennon. Wait. See, if I own the tooth, then I can sell little slices of it for like $5,000 a pop. I could turn $30,000 into like $500,000.
Right away. All right. Fourth item. Lee Harvey Oswald's wedding ring. Somebody
really
sent me this,
like
by the way.
Married, like,
I guess
that could be surprisingly cheap. I'm gonna say $7,200.
$7,200 for his ring. Well, I'm gonna say like $75,000.
Matt gets that one. $118,000 for Lee Harvey Oswald's wedding ring.
Really? Yeah. Like that's like it'd be different if it was like his, you know, shooting glasses or the stuff that.
That's if he's guilty. We don't. Same as O.J. Simpson. I remember with Cheryl McCollum was on. We were like, allegedly. We're like, yeah, you don't know. My favorite thing, and I post it all the time on Twitter, was and people do it on purpose now when they go to interview O.J. Simpson. They always say that he doesn't go to Southern California anymore because he doesn't want to run into the real killer.
The real. All right. I know we're about to wrap this, but I have a request for next time with Matthew. I want to talk with Matthew because of his depth of experience, and I think people would really enjoy, and I know I would, talking about what should we be doing. Like, I'm really good at picking apart the problems that we have. One of the things that I really like about Matt's writing, he's very often going, all right, this is what we're, let's talk about what we should be. That, to me, would be a really cool set of podcasts that I think people would be really interested in. So, folks, please write Derek if that's something that you're interested in. I'd love to talk with Matt about, hey, here's the problem. You've seen it all. Where should we be going? And I think that would be a really kick-ass conversation.
You know, you
yeah.
could do,
well, I,
you could
yeah,
do the whole
I,
thing.
I appreciate that, yeah. And I would say I wish that I had answers for some of these problems. As you said, they're easy to point out what the problems are. They're not easy to fix, but I really would love to have a dialogue about how we can begin that process.
We had a ton of people.
What we're missing. Yeah.
Gosh, we had a ton of people after you spoke about your possible solution for gun violence that reached out and said that was brilliant. Even some people that didn't hear the show when we were just talking about it here and there.
I'd love to take credit for that idea, but requiring mandatory insurance for firearms is not my original idea. I recognize the power of the human condition and the power of the economy.
Just say it was your idea. Don't worry.
You know, and we've got to enroll those if we're going to solve these fundamental problems, because people aren't. We do not think in our best interest as a whole. We just don't. We're very reptile brain in that kind of stuff.
Well,
it's been fun. It's been great. I really enjoyed this time.
Really enjoyed. Thank you so much, Matthew. This is awesome. I'm super happy we got this time. Like, this has been awesome.
Well, for more Josh and Matt, maybe you need a lawyer. Maybe you need advice. Maybe you were fired for spending too much on Lee Harvey Oswald's wedding ring and you stole the business from your company.
You would be
Check
fired.
Out Josh Schiffer at www.jdgrouplaw.com or on Twitter at Lawyer Schiff, or just Google Joshua Schiffer or ask me. For a little more Matthew Mangino, visit mattmangino.com. His articles and everything he is up to is there. Buy the book, The Executioner's Toll, And check him out on the Long Cry Network and on Twitter at Matthew T. Mangino. Gentlemen, thank you so much. The time flies, though, man.
Yeah, it was great. Thanks.
Fastest out. Thanks, y'all. This was awesome.